The sun was sinking towards the western horizon, and the elongated shadows cast by their camels flitted across the orange-yellow dunes when at last Penrod made out the streaming red banner of Emir Salida through the dust clouds ahead. "This is the front rank of the army," Jacob agreed. He rode close to Penrod's right hand so that he did not have to raise his voice. Other riders were within earshot. "Many of these men are Yalin. I have recognized two who carry a blood feud against me. They are of the family who drove me out of my tribe and made me an outcast. If they confront me, I will be honor-bound to kill them." "Then let us part company from them." The Nile was only a mile distant on their left hand. The whole army had been following the course of the river since they had joined it at Berber. At this late hour of the day, many other travellers were turning aside to water their animals on the river bank. They were too intent on their own affairs to remark the presence of the two strangers among them. Nevertheless, Penrod contrived to keep well clear of them. The grazing closer to the river bank was dense and luscious. The grass reached as high as the knees of their camels. Suddenly there was an explosion of wings from under the front pads of Jacob's mount, and a covey of quail rocketed into the air. These were the Syrian blue variety of their breed, larger than the common quail and highly prized for the pot. Jacob swiveled in his saddle and, with a whipping motion of his right hand, threw the heavy camel goad he carried. It cartwheeled through the air and smacked into one of the birds. In a burst of blue, gold, and chestnut feathers, the quail tumbled to earth. "Behold, Jacob, the mighty hunter," he exulted. The rest of the covey swung across the nose of Penrod's camel, and he made his throw. The goad clipped the head of the leading cockbird and spun on with almost no deflection. It thumped into a plump young hen and snapped her near wing. She came down heavily and scuttled away through the tall grass. Penrod jumped from the camel's back and chased her. She jinked and fluttered up, but he snatched her out of the air. Holding her by the head, he flicked his wrist and broke her neck. He retrieved his goad and the cock's carcass, then ran back to his mount and swung up into the saddle. "Behold, Suleimani Ifara, the humble traveller from Jeddah, who would never boast of his prowess." "Then I will not embarrass him by speaking of it," Jacob agreed ruefully. So they came down to the river. Hundreds of horses and camels were spread out along the bank, drinking. Others were grazing on the green growth that bordered it. Men were filling their waterskins, and some were bathing in the shallows. Penrod picked out a spot on the bank that was well away from any of these people. They hobbled the camels and let them drink while they filled the waterskins and cut bundles of fresh grass. They turned the hobbled camels loose to graze and built a small cooking fire. They roasted the trio of quail, golden brown and oozing fragrant juices. Then Jacob went to the cow camel and milked her into a bowl. He warmed the milk and they washed down with it a round of durra bread topped with a slice of the cheese, which reeked more powerfully than the goat that had produced it. They ended the meal with a handful of dates and apricots. It was tastier fare than Penrod had ever enjoyed in the dining room of the Jazeera Club. Afterwards, they lay under the stars with their heads close together. "How far are we from the town of Abu Hamed?" Penrod asked. With his spread fingers, Jacob indicated a segment of the sky. 2 hours. Penrod translated the angle to time. "Abu Hamed is where we must leave the river and cut across the bight to the wells of Gakdul." 2 days' travel from Abu Hamed. "Once we pass the vanguard of the dervish, we will be able to travel at better speed." "It will be a great pity to kill the camels." Jacob rose up on one elbow and watched them grazing nearby. He whistled softly, and the cream-coloured cow wandered over to him, stepping short against her hobble. He fed her one of the rounds of durra cake and stroked her ear as she crunched it up. "Oh, compassionate Jacob, you will cut a man's throat as happily as you break wind, but you grieve for a beast who was born to die?" Penrod rolled onto his back and spread his arms like a crucifix. "You stand the first watch. I will take the second. We will rest until the moon is at its zenith. Then we will go on." He closed his eyes and began almost at once to snore softly. When Jakob woke him, the midnight chill had already soaked through his woolen cloak, and he looked to the sky. It was time. Jakob was ready. They stood up and without a word went to the camels, loosened the hobbles, and mounted up. The watchfires of the sleeping army guided them. The smoke lay in a dense fog along the wadis and concealed their movements. The pads of the camels made no sound, and they had secured their baggage with great care so that it neither creaked nor clattered. None of the sentries challenged them as they passed each encampment. Within the 2 hours that Jakob had predicted, they passed the village of Abu Hamed. They kept well clear, but their scent roused the village dogs, whose petulant yapping faded as they left the river and struck out along the ancient caravan route that crossed the great bight of the Nile. By the time dawn broke, they had left the Dervish army far behind. In the middle of the next afternoon, they couched the camels in the lengthening shadow of a small volcanic hillock and fed them on the fodder they had cut on the riverbank. Despite the severity of the march, the camels ate hungrily. The two men examined them at rest, but found no ominous swellings on their limbs or shale cuts on their pads. "They have travelled well, but the hard marches lie ahead." Penrod took the first watch and climbed to the top of the hillock so that he could overlook their back trail. He panned his telescope over the south horizon in the direction of Abu Hamed, but could pick out no dust cloud or any other sign of pursuit. He built a knee-high wall of loose volcanic rocks to screen himself in this exposed position, and settled comfortably behind it. For the first time since they had left the Nile, he felt easier. He waited for the cool of the evening, and before the sun reached the horizon, he sat up and once more glassed the southern horizon. It was only a yellow feather of dust, small and ephemeral, showing almost coyly for a few minutes, then dissipating and fading away as though it were merely an illusion, a trick of the heated air. Then it materialized again and hovered in the heat like a tiny yellow bird. On the caravan road, fairly on our tracks, the dust rises over soft ground and subsides again when the trail crosses shale or lava beds, he explained to himself the intermittent appearance of the dust cloud. It seems that Al-Nur's memory has returned at last. Yet these cannot be horsemen. There is no water. Camels are the only animals that can survive out here. There are no camels in the Dervish army that can run us down. Our mounts are the swiftest and finest. He stared through the lens of his telescope, but could make out nothing under the dust. Still too far off, he thought. They must be all of 7 or 8 miles away. He ran down the hill. Jakob saw him coming and could tell from his haste that trouble was afoot. He had the camels saddled and loaded before Penrod reached them. Penrod jumped into his saddle, and his mount lurched up, groaning and spitting. He turned her head northwards and urged her into trot. Jakob rode up alongside him. "What have you seen?" "Dust on our back trail. Camels." "How can you tell that?" "What horse can survive so far from water?" "When the Agajirs are in hot pursuit of either elephant or men, they use both their camels and their horses. At the beginning of the hunt, they ride the camels and also use them to carry the water. That is how they save the horses until they have their quarry in sight. Then they change to them for the final chase. You have seen the quality of their horses. No camel can run against them." He looked back over his shoulder. "If those are the Agajirs of Osman Atalan, they will have us in sight by dawn tomorrow." They rode on through the night. Penrod gave no thought to conserving the water in the skins. A little before midnight they stopped just long enough to give each animal 2 bucketfuls of water. Penrod stretched out on the ground and used an inverted milk bowl as a sounding board to pick up the reverberation of distant hoofs. When he placed his ear against it, he could hear nothing. He did not allow this to lull him into complacency. Only when they sighted the pursuers at dawn would they know how far they were trailing behind them. They wasted no time and padded on through the desolation and the hissing silence of the desert. As the first soft light of dawn gave definition to the landscape, Penrod halted again. Once again he was prodigal with the remaining water, and ordered Jakob to give each of the camels 2 more buckets and the remainder of the fodder. "At this rate, we will have emptied the skins by this evening," Yakub grumbled. "By this evening we will either have reached the wells of Gakdul or we will be dead. Let them drink and eat. It will lighten their load and give strength to their legs." He walked back 100 yards and once again used the milk bowl as a sounding cup. For a few minutes he heard nothing and grunted with relief. But some deep instinct made him linger. Then he heard it, a tremble of air within his eardrum, so faint it might have been a trick of the dawn breeze sweeping over the rocks. He wetted his forefinger and held it up. There was no wind. He lowered his head to the bowl, cupped his hands round his ear, and closed his eyes. Silence at first. He took a deep breath and held it. At the outer reaches of his hearing there was a susurration like fine sand agitated gently in a dried gourd, or the breathing of a beloved woman sleeping at his side in the watches of the night. Even in this fraught situation an image of Rebecca flared in his memory, so young and lovely in the bed beside him, her hair spread over them both like cloth of gold. He thrust away the picture, stood up and went back to the camels. "They are behind us," he said quietly. "How far?" Yakub asked. "We will be able to see them clearly in the first rays of the sun." They both glanced into the east. The sun cast a nimbus around a distant hilltop, as though it were the rugged head of an ancient saint. "And they will see us just as clearly," Yakub's voice was husky, and he cleared his throat. "How far to the wells of Gakdul?" Penrod asked. "More than half a day's ride," Yakub answered. "Too far. On those horses they will catch us long before we reach the wells." "What terrain lies ahead? Is there a place for us to take cover where we might evade them?" "We approach the Turbi Kabir," Yakub pointed ahead. "There is good reason why it is called the Great Graveyard." This was one of the most formidable obstacles along the entire crossing of the Bight. It was a salt pan 20 miles across. The surface was level as a sheet of frosted glass, unmarred by a single ripple or undulation other than the broad indentation of the caravan road. Both its verges were outlined by the skeletons of the men and camels who over the centuries had perished along the way. The noon sunlight, reflecting off the diamond white salt crystals, lit the noonday sky with a glare that could be seen from many leagues in every direction. A camel standing in the centre of this great white place could be clearly recognised from the perimeter. The unrelenting sunlight, reflected and magnified by the shining surface, could roast man and beast like a slow fire. "There is no other way forward. We must go on." They put the camels to the crossing. Refreshed by the copious draughts of water and the fodder they had eaten, they paced out strongly. As the daylight strengthened, the sky ahead became incandescent, like a metal shield raised to white heat in the forge of Vulcan. Abruptly, they left the area of dunes and undulated gravel hills and rode out onto the pan. With theatrical timing, the sun soared out above the eastern hills and struck into their faces with its stinging lash. Penrod could feel it sucking the moisture from his skin and frying the contents of his skull. He groped in his saddlebag and brought out a piece of curved ivory into which he had carved horizontal eye slits so narrow that they blocked out most of the reflected glare. He had copied this from an illustration in the Book of Arctic Travel by Clavering and Sabine that depicted a native Eskimo of Greenland wearing such a contrivance, carved from whalebone to ward off snow blindness. Under the goads, the camels broke into the gait that the Arabs called drinking the wind, a long striding trot that sent the miles swiftly behind them. With every few strides, either Penrod or Yakub swiveled round and stared back into the shimmering glare. When the enemy came, it was with shocking suddenness. At one moment the pan behind them was bare and white, with not the least sign upon it of man or beast. At the next, the dervish column poured out from among the gravel hills and rode on to the white expanse. The weird play of sunlight created an illusion of perspective and foreshortened distances. Although they were still several miles away, they seemed so close that Penrod fancied he could make out the features of each individual. As Yakub had predicted, they were riding camels, pack camels. The Agagias sat up in front of the huge balloon-like waterskins, Each rider led his horse behind him on a long rein. Osman Atalan was on the leading camel. The folds of his green turban covered his lower face, but his seat in the saddle was unmistakable, head held high and shoulders proud. Beside him rode Al-Nur. Bunched up behind the leading pair, Penrod counted six more Agajis. Both sides spotted each other in the same instant. If the pursuers shouted, it was too far for the sound to reach him. Without undue haste, the Agajis dismounted from their camels. Two men were acting as camel handlers, and they gathered up the reins. Osman and each of his men led out a horse and watered it. Then the Agajis tightened the girths and swung up into the saddle. This changeover took only the time that a Red Sea diver might hold his breath when he goes down to fill his net with pearl oysters from the deep coral reef. Then the horsemen bunched up and came across the shimmering salt surface at an alarming pace. Penrod and Jakob leant forward in their saddles and with thrusting movements of their hips urged their mounts to the top of their speed. The camels reached out in a long-legged gallop. For a mile and then another, the two bands raced on, neither gaining nor faltering. Then Hulumaya, Osman's cream-coloured mare, broke from the pack. She came on with her mane and long golden tail floating in the wind, a pale wraith against the dazzling plain of salt. Penrod saw almost at once that no camel could hold off this horse over any distance, and he knew the tactics Osman would adopt. He would ride up behind them and hamstring their camels on the run. Penrod tried to conjure up a plan to counter this. He could not rely on a lucky bullet to bring down the mare. Perhaps instead he should let her come close, then turn back unexpectedly, taking Osman by surprise, and use his camel's height and weight to rush down on the mare. He might be able to force a collision that would inflict such an injury on her that she would be out of the race. In truth, he knew that such a plan was futile. The mare was not only fleet but nimble. Osman was probably the most skilled horseman in all the dervish ranks. Between them they would make a mockery of any clumsy charge he could mount. If by some remote chance he succeeded in crippling the mare, the rest of the Beja Agajirs would be upon them in the next instant, their long blades bared. The tail of the green turban had blown clear out of Osman's face. And now he was so close that Penrod could make out his features clearly. Crisp curls of his beard were smoothed back by the wind of the mare's run. His gaze was locked on Penrod's face.
"Abijanriji," Osman called. "This is our moment. It is written."
Penrod drew the Martini Henry carbine from its boot under his knee and half turned in the saddle. He could not make the full turn and face his enemy to mount the rifle to his shoulder without throwing his camel off balance. He swung up the rifle with his right hand, as though it was a pistol, and tried to settle his aim. The camel lurched and jerked under him, and the rifle barrel made wild and unpredictable circles. At the full reach of his right arm, the muscles strained and tired swiftly. He could hold his aim no longer, and fired. The recoil jarred his wrist, and the trigger guard smashed back into his fingers. His aim was so wild that he did not mark the flight or strike of the bullet. Osman's replying laughter was natural and easy. He was so close now that his voice carried over the sounds of hooves and the rush of the wind.
"Put up your gun. We are warriors of the blade, you and I."
His mare came on apace, now so close that Penrod could see the white froth flying from the snaffle between her jaws. The scabbard of Osman's broadsword was trapped under his left knee. He reached down and drew out the blade, then held up its shining length for Penrod to see.
"This is a man's weapon."
Penrod felt the strong temptation to respond to his challenge and take him on with a sword, but he knew that more was at stake than pride and honour. The fate of an army, of his countrymen, the city of Khartoum and all within the walls, Rebecca Benbrook too, hung on the outcome of this race. Duty dictated that he must eschew any heroics. He ejected the empty case from the breech of his rifle and took another round from his bandolier to replace it. He locked the breech block, but before he could turn back to fire again at Osman, Jakob called to him in urgent tones. He glanced at him and saw that he was pointing ahead, standing high in the saddle, waving his arms above his head, screaming in wild excitement. Penrod followed the direction of his finger, and his heart bounded. Out of the white glare of the salt pan ahead, a squadron of mounted men appeared, their camels racing towards him on a converging track. There was no mistaking that their intentions were warlike. How many? He wondered. In the clouds of white dust it was impossible to guess, but they came on, rank upon rank. 100, if not more, he realized. But who were they? Not Arabs, that's certain. Hope stirred. None of them wore the jibba, and their faces were unbearded. They rushed towards each other, and Penrod saw the khaki of their tunics and the distinctive shape of their pith helmets. British, he exulted. Scouts from Stuart's Camel Corps. Penrod swiveled in the saddle and looked back. Osman was standing tall in his stirrups, peering at the approaching ranks. Behind him his agajiers had reined down from the charge and were milling in confusion. Penrod looked ahead again and saw that the commander of the Camel Corps had ordered a halt. His men were dismounting and couching their camels to form the classic square. It was done with precision. The camels knelt in an unbroken wall, and behind each crouched the rider, with rifle and bayonet presented across his animal's back. The white faces, although tinted by the sun, were clean-shaven and calm. Penrod felt a breathtaking surge of pride. These men were his comrades, the flowering, the finest army on earth. He ripped the turban from his head to show them his face, then waved the cloth over his head. "Hold your fire!" he yelled. "British! I am British!" He saw the officer, standing behind the first rank of troopers with drawn sword, step forward and give him a long, hard scrutiny. Now he was only 150 paces from the square. "I am a British officer!" The other man made an unmistakable gesture with his sword, and Penrod heard his order repeated by the sergeants and non-commissioned officers. "Hold your fire! Steady! Steady the guards! Hold your fire!" Penrod looked back again and saw that Osman was close behind him. Although his agajiers were still in confusion, he was charging alone into the face of the British square. Again Penrod raised the carbine and aimed at Osman's mare. He knew that this was the one thing that might turn him aside. Now they were no more than three lengths apart, and even from the unstable back of a galloping camel, Penrod's carbine was a deadly menace. Nevertheless, if he had aimed at the man, Osman would not have been daunted by it. But by this time Penrod had learnt enough about him to know that he would not push the mare into the muzzle of the rifle. Osman reined back, his face furrowed with rage. "I was wrong about you, coward!" he shouted. Penrod felt his own rage flare. "There will be another time," he promised. "I pray God that it is so." Within 60 yards of the British square, Osman turned. He brought the mare down to a trot and rode away to rejoin his agajiers. The square opened to let in Penrod, Yakub following. He rode up to the officer and slid to the ground. "Good morning, Major," he saluted, and Kenwick stared at him in astonishment. "Ballantyne, you do turn up in odd places. You might have got yourself shot. Your arrival was at a most appropriate moment. I noticed you were having a spot of bother. What in the name of the devil are you doing out here in the middle of the blue? I have dispatches from General Gordon for General Stuart." "Then you are in luck. We are the advance guard. General Stuart is with the main body of the relief column, not more than an hour behind us." He looked out over the camels and the kneeling men at the front of his square. "But first things first, who was the dervish bounder chasing after you?"
"One of the emirs, a fellow called Osman Atalan, head of the Beja tribe."
"My solemn oath, I've heard of him. He's a nasty piece of work, by all accounts. We'd better deal with him." He strode away towards the front of the square.
"Sergeant Major, shoot that fellow."
"Sir." The Sergeant Major was a burly figure with a magnificent pair of moustaches. He picked out two of his best marksmen.
"Webb and Rogers, shoot that dervish."
The two troopers leant across the backs of their crouched camels and took aim.
"In your own time," the sergeant major told them.
Penrod found he was holding his breath. He had told Kenwick of Osman's position and rank to discourage just such an order. He had vaguely hoped that some chivalrous instinct might have dissuaded Kenwick from shooting down an emir. At Waterloo, Wellington would never have ordered his sharpshooters to make Bonaparte their target. One of the troopers fired, but Osman was riding steadily away, and the range was already over 500 yards. The bullet must have passed close, for the mare swished her tail as though to drive off a tsetse fly. But Osman Atalan did not deign even to look back. Instead, he deliberately slowed his horse to a walk. The second trooper fired, and this time they saw dust fly. Again, the bullet had missed by very little. Osman continued to walk the mare away. Each marksman fired two more shots at him. By then, he was out of range. "Cease firing, Sergeant Major," Kenrick snapped. Then, in an aside to Penrod, "Damn fellow has the luck of the fox," he was smiling thinly. "But you have to admire his cool performance." "We will almost certainly be treated to other virtuoso performances in the near future," Penrod agreed. Kenwick glanced at him, sensing the note of censure in his tone. "A sporting sentiment, Ballantyne. However, I do believe that one should not accord too much respect to the enemy. We must bear in mind that we are here to kill them." "And vice versa." But Penrod did not say it aloud. In the distance, they watched Osman Atalan join up with his agajies and ride away southwards towards Abu Hamed. "Now," said Kenwick, "General Stuart will probably be pleased to see you." "And vice versa, sir." This time Penrod voiced the thought. Kenwick scribbled a note in his dispatch book, tore out the page, and handed it to him. "If you wander around the countryside dressed like that, it's likely you'll be shot as a spy. I shall send young Stapleton back with you. Please inform General Stuart that we're making good progress, and apart from this Atalan fellow, we have made no other contact with the enemy." "Major, please do not be lulled into believing that happy state of affairs will persist much longer. For the last several days I have been riding in company with a vast concourse of the Dervish. All of them are coming this way."
"How large a force?" Kenwick asked. "Difficult to say for certain, sir. Too many to count. However, I would estimate somewhere between 30,000 and 50,000.
Kenwick rubbed his hands with glee.
"So, all in all, you might say that we're in for an interesting few days."
"You might indeed, sir." Kenwick called over a young ensign, the lowest rank of commissioned officer. "Stapleton, go back with Captain Ballantyne and see him through the lines. Don't get him or yourself shot." Percival Stapleton gazed at Penrod with awe. He was not much more than 17, fresh-faced and eager as a puppy. The two rode back with Yakub along the ancient caravan road. For the first few miles, Percy was struck dumb with hero worship. Captain Ballantyne was a holder of the Victoria Cross, and to have the honour of riding with him was the pinnacle of his 16 months of military experience. Over the next mile he summoned up his courage and addressed a few respectful remarks and questions to him. He was highly gratified when Penrod responded in a friendly fashion, and Percy became relaxed and chatty. Penrod recognised him as a prime source of information, encouraged him to speak freely, and quickly picked up most of the regimental gossip from him. This was highly coloured by Percy's pride in the regiment, and his almost delirious anticipation of going into action for the first time.
"Everybody knows that General Stuart is a fine soldier, one of the best in the entire army," the youngster informed him importantly. "All the men under his command have been drawn from the first-line regiments of Guards and Fusiliers. I am with the 2nd Grenadiers." He sounded as though he could hardly believe his good fortune.
"Is that why General Gordon has been waiting so long in Khartoum for your arrival?" Penrod needled the boy with surgical skill. Percy bridled.
"The delay is not the General's fault. Every man in the column is as keen as mustard and spoiling for a fight."
Penrod lifted an eyebrow, and the boy rushed on hotly.
"Because of the haste with which the politicians in London forced us to leave Wadi Halfa, we were obliged to wait at Gakdul for the reinforcements to reach us. We were less than 1,000 strong, and the camels were sick and weak from paucity of fodder. We were in no fit state to meet the enemy."
"What is the position now?"
"The reinforcements arrived only 2 days ago from Wadi Halfa. They brought up fodder, fresh camels, and the provisions we were lacking. The general ordered the advance at once. Now we have men enough to do the job," he said with the sublime confidence of the very young.
"How many is enough?" Penrod asked.
"Almost 2,000. "'Do you know how many Dervish there are?' Penrod asked with interest. "'Oh, quite a few, I shouldn't wonder. "'But we are British, don't you see?' "'Of course we are,' Penrod smiled. "'There is nothing else to say, is there?' "'They topped the next rise, and on the stony plain ahead appeared the main body. "'It was advancing in a compact square formation, with the pack camels in the centre. "'There appeared to be many more than 2,000. "'They came on at a good, steady rate, and it was clear that they were under firm command. "'With young Percy in uniform to smooth the way, the pickets let them into the marching square. "'A party of mounted staff officers was coming up behind the front rank. "'Penrod recognised General Stuart. "'He had seen him at Wadi Halfa, but had not been presented to him. "'He was a handsome man, stiff-backed and tall in the saddle, "'exuding an air of confidence and command.' Penrod knew the man at his side rather better. He was Major Harding, the Camel Corps senior intelligence officer. He pointed at Penrod and spoke a few words to the general. Stuart glanced in Penrod's direction and nodded. Harding rode over. Ah, Ballantyne, the traditional bad penny. Penny now worth at least a shilling, sir. I have dispatches from General Gordon in Khartoum. Have you, my goodness? That's a guinea's worth. "'Come along. General Stuart will be pleased to see you.' "'They rode back to join the staff. "'General Stuart motioned to Penrod to fall in alongside his own camel. "'Penrod saluted. "'Captain Penrod Ballantyne, 10th Hussars, "'with dispatches from General Gordon in Khartoum. "'Gordon is still alive?' "'Very much so, sir.' "'Stuart was studying him keenly. "'Good to have your confirmation.' You can hand over the dispatches to Harding. Sir, General Gordon would not commit anything to paper in case it fell into the hands of the Mahdi. I have only a verbal report. Then you had best give that to me directly. Harding can take notes. Go ahead. My first duty, sir, is to inform you of the enemy order of battle, as we are aware of it. Stuart listened intently, leaning forward in the saddle. His features were lean and suntanned, his gaze steady and intelligent. He did not interrupt Penrod while he reported the conditions of the defenders in Khartoum. Penrod ended the first part of his report succinctly. General Gordon estimates that he can hold out for another 30 days. However, the food supplies have been reduced to well below survival level. The level of the Nile is falling rapidly, exposing the defences. He has asked me to emphasise to you, sir, that every day that passes renders his position more precarious. Stuart made no effort to explain the delays he had encountered. He was a man of direct action, not one who made excuses. I understand, he said simply. Go on, please. General Gordon will fly the flags of Egypt and Great Britain from the tower of Mukran Fort day and night while the city is still being defended. With the telescope, the flags can be seen from as far downstream as the heights of the Shabluka Gorge. "'I hope shortly to verify that for myself,' Stuart nodded. Although he listened to Penrod with attention, his eyes were constantly busy, watching over the orderly formation of his square as it moved steadily southwards. "'My journey from the city brought me through the midst of the enemy formations. I can give you my own estimate of their dispositions if you consider that might be of use, General.' I am listening. The commander of the Dervish vanguard is the Emir Salida of the Jalin tribe. He has probably 15,000 warriors under his red banner. The Jalin are the northernmost tribe of the Sudan. Salida is a man in his late 60s, but he has a formidable reputation. The commander of the centre is the Emir Osman Atalan of the Beja. Stuart narrowed his eyes at the name. Obviously he had heard it before. Osman has brought approximately 20,000 of his own men from the siege of Khartoum. They have Martini Henry rifles captured from the Egyptians and a great store of ammunition. As I am sure you are well aware, sir, the Dervish prefer to get to close quarters and use the sword. Guns? Although they have Nordenfelts, Krupps, and plentiful supplies of ammunition in Omdurman, I have seen none being brought north with this wing of their army. "'I know you're an old hand at Arab fighting, Ballantyne. "'Where will they meet us, do you suppose?'
"I believe that they will want to deny you the water, sir," Penrod replied. In the desert, everything came down sooner or later to that. "The next water is at the wells of Abu Kli. It is sparse and brackish, but they will try to prevent you using it. The approach to the wells is through a rocky defile. I would guess that they will offer battle there, probably as you debouch from the narrow way." Harding had the map ready. Stuart took it and spread it on the front of his saddle. Penrod pressed close enough to read it with him. "Point out to me the spot where you think they may attack," Stuart ordered. When Penrod did so, Stuart studied it for a short while. "I had planned to bivouac tonight on the north side of Tabir Kebe." He placed his finger on the spot. "However, in the light of this new information, it may be better to force march today and reach the head of the defile before dark. This will place us in a flexible position in the morning." Penrod made no comment. His opinion had not been asked. Stuart rolled the map. "Thank you, Captain. I think you will be most useful with the vanguard under Major Kenwick. Will you ride forward again and place yourself under his command?" Penrod saluted. And as he rode off, Stuart called after him. "Before you join Kenwick, go back and see the quartermaster. Get yourself a decent uniform. From here, you look like a bloody dervish yourself. Somebody is going to take a pot at you."